This is writer and game designer Robin D. Laws.
And this is game designer and writer Kenneth Height.
And this is our podcast, Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff.
Bandwidth brought to you by Pelgrane Press.
Stuff we're here to talk about in this episode include...
Subgenius Roleplaying.
A Chrono Stunting Ship.
Bitters.
And the Island of Bermeja.
I'm Ken.
And I'm Robin.
And we're talking about stuff. Specifically, Robin, we're talking about a phenomenon that occurs every January. No, not the sudden surge in gym memberships that vanishes by the Ides of March, but something far more transformative for the tabletop landscape.
You mean New Game Master Month, Ken. The time when we take the uninitiated, those who've spent their lives safely on the player's side of the screen, and gently push them into the glorious yet terrifying spotlight of the Game Master's chair.
It's a transition more profound than any alchemical transmutation. And this year, for those who want their first foray into GMing to be as approachable as a warm sunbeam, Magical Kitties Save the Day is a featured game.
It's the perfect starting point for new GMs. While you and I can spend hours debating the occult significance of 19th century Parisian sewers, some people just want to play a really cute kitty who can throw fireballs.
And let's be honest, Robin, compared to some of the eldritch horrors we've summoned in the consulting occultist hut, a hyper-intelligent raccoon is a refreshingly manageable antagonist.
Exactly. If you've been pausing...
Oh no, here we go.
If you've been pausing before taking the leap, New Game Master Month provides a free step-by-step seminar starting in January at newgamemastermonth.com. It's a series of twice-weekly posts that guide you through every moment of preparation.
You get expert advice, a supportive community, and an easy entry game designed to be run by those who find a 400-page rule book a bit
hysterical.
I was not going to say that. No.
By February, you'll be an actual GM. It really is the cat's pajamas of intro workshops. So don't let your New Year's resolutions be a tale of woe.
Go to newgamemastermonth.com to sign up for the totally free seminar.
And remember, in the world of Magical Kitties Save the Day, the only thing more powerful than your magic is your personality.
I'm ending the segment now, Robin.
Fair, I think I used up my 9 lives on that last one.
The rattle of dice, the thump of miniatures, the crunch of Doritos, and the benevolent gaze of Peter Frampton coming alive welcome us once more into the gaming hut. But look at that. I don't know if maybe we got some Mountain Dew on the album cover, but Peter Frampton looks like he's grinning and smoking a pipe because beloved Patreon backer Toonspew has asked us to tackle the Church of the Subgenius from any angle and to dedicate that segment to twerp. Ergo, we say, or perhaps, does Toonspew say? Do you say? Who says?
I'm the one deciding that this is a gaming hut in which we are going to work out what a Church of the Subgenius role-playing game would look like. And the first thing we would do before determining what that game would be and what its core activity is we would do some research. So Ken, you've researched some pretty risky topics over the years, but the risk that you will be entirely overcome by Slack is one that both Toonspew and I insist that you undertake, and therefore clue us in on the Church of the Subgenius and its prophet, J.R. Bob Dobbs.
That's right. J.R. Bob Dobbs, a smiling, pipe-smoking, all-American, all-Tibetan, all-Yeti Superman, was contacted in 1953 by Jehovah One, a alien/god, while repairing a television, and he was offered leadership of the world conspiracy, but he turned it down. He became a bodhisattva, if you will, to preach the ways of Slack to the true subgeniuses, who turn out to be those descended from Yeti. The conspiracy that he rejected has brainwashed everyone else, who are called the Pinks, into consumerism. And so the first and foremost of your subgenius commandments is to slack off. and not be consuming stuff all the time, except, of course, products from the Church of the Subgenius, which you should consume because Bob wants money.
Right. Well, yeah, everybody needs a merch line to keep their business model going.
Religions more than most. And then other tenets include rebelling against law and order, doing your part to clear the earth of non-Yetis. I think that's more of an aspiration than an actual action plan, but I'm not the boss of you. That's the point of Subgenius. And to exploit the fears of the Pinks, make them nervous, bring terror to the heart of the conspiracy. And you continue this culture jam until the aliens arrive from Planet X, and they will carry all true Subgeniuses to meet sexy space mates and probably also destroy the planet. But that's okay. You'll be off with your sexy space mates. The X Day was first prophesied by Bob himself for July 5th, 1998. So far as we know, it has not yet happened. Probably the conspiracy has moved the calendar, but one reading of the gospel by the minister of Sinister is that Bob, when he wrote down X Day, wrote it down upside down. And so it's actually 8661 that will be X Day. So I guess keep your options open and your powder dry, because the aliens could come at any moment, like unto a thief in the night.
Right. So this is one of the great flowerings of 90s counterculture. The irony is high here. And this goes back to an era of zine culture and mailing away for things. And I think is, because of its association with Robert Anton Wilson, is also beloved by at least a fair segment of hipster nerddom as well.
Yeah, it was actually 80s counterculture back in the day, 80s slacker culture, because I don't say into the Church of the Subgenius, but it was, as you say, part of the Robert Anton Wilson sphere. And so I certainly read the Book of the Subgenius and was even still interested enough to pick up Revelation X, the Bob Apocryphon, which came out in 94. I got the first Book of the Subgenius in 83. There's another one that was republished later in the 80s. So I own at least both of those. And I think I also own Three-Fisted Tales of Bob, which is a religious fiction for the church. The church was founded in 1979 by the Texas writer Ivan Stang and his friend Philo Drummond. And they were both big Robert Anton Wilson fans. They made him Pope Bob of the church, and also by the Discordian movement, which was a late 60s, early 70s counterculture established by a guy named Carrie Thornley. And in a lovely syncretic touch, Eris, the goddess of discord, is the wife of Jehovah One. The church has also borrowed other deities, including Yog-Sothoth, Klaatu, and Dracula. And it has basically, since the 80s, been detouring and bricklaging conspiracy culture, much as the game Illuminati and much of Steve Jackson's output has been doing, again, since about that time. And also, like the rest of that cultural efflorescence, it spread, as you say, Robin, through zines initially, and then was very much an early adoption of the early adopters of the internet. You could not go on Usenet without hitting a invocation of Bob Dobbs for a while.
Right. Stang is the pen name of Douglas St. Clair Smith, who was born in 1953. And whether you say it's 80s or 90s, it's Gen X. It's Gen X irony culture.
Absolutely.
And it's another example of boomers who created Gen X irony culture. So this is very much in the cultural stream of Letterman, the founders of the National Lampoon, the original SNL team. And it's got a wise-ass upending of all of the values of the American culture in particular. So it's most obviously an assault on the work ethic. Therefore, the thing that you're seeking is slack, to do nothing. I think obviously that business culture, work culture has struck back by having one of the primary work platforms now being called Slack. Or is that an inside job? We don't know yet. But it definitely creates this sort of comic, knowing, sarcastic view of conspiratorial thought that I think we'd be well to revert to compared to the current position that conspiracy culture has in the zeitgeist.
Yes, if we could make it something that we photocopy and laugh at, it would be better for everybody. And it's, as you say, it's a culture jam of the American work ethic and the sort of fundamental straight-faced American culture. It also parodies both Scientology and evangelical Christianity, and it's basically a Gnostic framework with the Yetis and the Pinks instead of the, you know, ethereals and the people of clay. But Gnosticism, of course, is what you hang most good conspiracies on anyway. So there we are. Stang, by the way, lives the bit. He keeps the kayfabe. He refuses to call the church a joke or a parody, preferring the formulation both a satire and a real stupid religion. So,
well, we did say irony, so it has to exist on two levels. You can't come out and say what it is, or it stops being irony. It just becomes satire.
It stops being good. And so that is Subgenius. And if you are a nerd of a certain vintage or a certain varietal, all of this has been old news, and you're desperately saying, so how do we play a Church of the Subgenius role-playing game? I feel like, Robin, in honor of, you know, Steve Jackson, it should be GURPS, whatever else it is. This should be a GURPS campaign, GURPS Subgenius, or GURPS whatever you want to call it. But why would we go so far as to introduce sensible, elegant game mechanics to something that is deliberately a farrago?
If we're going for irony, having the most hardcore, detailed, simulation-oriented system to power this sort of nonsense, I guess, would be an apt layer of irony. So let's leave aside what I would actually do and say we're doing that.
Well, I mean, we could also go with the spirit of Slack and use Jonathan Tweet's warp system, because I feel like Over the Edge is a kissing cousin, at least, to the Church of the Subgenius, just tuned a little bit more towards paranoia than to vibes.
Yes, it's a little more serious-minded, but definitely is another offshoot of this 80s, 90s version of counterculture, the sarcastic critical counterculture that followed the more optimistic 60s counterculture. So what's the core activity? Who are you? What do you do? Clearly, you are Yetis, or at least you hope you're a Yeti. You're certainly a recipient of the truth of Slack and the word of Bob Dobbs. And therefore, your goal is to do nothing.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, there are pinks who are in the way of your doing nothing, or in the way of other people doing nothing, or are at least trying to forestall the imminent arrival of the aliens and their sexy spacemates. And so you periodically have to get off the couch where you're gluing zines together and watching television and go off and do things in order to exploit the fears of the pink and to lay the groundwork, at least, for the clearing of the earth of the non-Yetis. Although I'm not sure why you have to clear the earth of non-Yetis, since you, the Yetis, will eventually be departing. But I guess that's one of the mysteries you'll have to answer, right?
That's a mystery of the faith, right? If it didn't have incompatible dogma and doctrine, it would hardly be a real religion now, would it?
Exactly.
So I feel like with a Church of the Subgenius adventure, as you say, the goal is to do nothing. So the goal is to sort of reset to a vibe state, and there should be sort of a slacker style series of random encounters as opposed to a plan. And then you are detouring or culture jamming objects of order and authority as you encounter them. So sort of like a Marx Brothers movie or an animated cartoon, you're moving through it and something is happening, and maybe it's part of the conspiracy and you can recognize it, and maybe it's just a pink getting above themselves and you want to.
So the obvious structure then is Richard Linklater's Slacker.
Right. Yeah.
Where it's just a series of weird encounters. You know, having a plot, that would be very pink. So you just have a series of encounters.
That would be pink. It would not be Slack. That's what it wouldn't be.
And you either, you know, move the dial towards Slack, or move the dial toward things happening and order being established. And so it's basically an avant-garde hex crawl, right? Where you're just moving from one random encounter to another. And whatever shape the adventure begins to take on is something that you have to subvert. Mm-hmm. Normally, you want the story to have a plot, but if there's a threat of like a build-up and a climax and a resolution, that's structure, that's order. You want to subvert the order. So what you want to do is, this is, I guess, the ultimate game for the subverting player who wants to riff off what is being done rather than to do things. Yeah. And therefore, it's the way to throw that person into the ultimate crisis, where this is now the desired activity. And so they're going to have to out-subvert themselves by trying to make the plot happen. And as that occurs, perhaps you even like accrue pink points as you make things happen and make logical stories occur, and have to either shed those pink points by behaving in a less lawful, less orderly, more random fashion, Or it will turn out, in fact, that you're not a Yeti at all, and you will not get your spacemate.
Right, yeah. And you can use the gifts of Bob Dobbs and the power of Slack to sort of slide things toward joyful or at least lazy chaos. But if you're spending your Slack, then you're more vulnerable to those pink points if they accomplish them. And you should not be using them, as you say, to further a story, more to bring out the inherent Slack in every social encounter and maybe find a fellow Yeti, maybe just harass a pink. But whatever you do, as you say, you know, you're in a scene. If the scene starts to take shape, it's your job to unshape it, but in a way that still preserves Slack and general not doing a lot. You know, you don't want to gain things. You're not trying to accumulate Slack points. You are, I think, best understood as using your Slack to get rid of any pinkness that might be accreting around your edges. Heaven forfend.
Yes, because if Slack is a resource that you can accumulate, that's the least Slack thing to do.
Right, yeah, that would be the opposite Slack of that.
That's a paradox right in itself. You want to have the absence of pink, not the presence of Slack, because Slack cannot be present. It can only be experienced. And so among these encounters, you will run into like Yogg-Sothoth and Klaatu and Dracula, and they'll try to give you missions, and you will have to try and avoid following those missions. And in fact, you will find that there are others. There are your antagonists are the people who follow the mission, right? And are trying to make things happen and rope you into those things. And so the anti-climax is the climax that you're pursuing. And if you end the session saying that nothing really happened, then you're successful. And so I guess really, finally, ultimately, to continue to build the idea of a Church of the Subgenius role-playing game is the least Slack thing possible. So let's sell some merch and get on to another segment.
Moving drama.
Hilarious comedy.
And you are the sole protagonist.
Page Turners is my game of personal storytelling for one player and one GM.
Coming in February from Pelgrane Press.
Longtime listeners know Hillfolk, my game of dramatic group play.
Winner of the coveted Diana Jones Award.
Page Turners shifts its dynamic down to the intimate scale of a single main character whose fiction you weave on the fly with one other creator.
Shockingly simple rules keep the focus on emotional interaction.
Extensive guidance helps you shape satisfying outcomes.
Writers Sarah Sam Saltiel, Wade Rocket, and Ruth Tillman join Robin in presenting 11 scenarios spanning a wealth of genres and tones.
Scenarios include
Jazz Age Ambition and Glamour,
a childhood haunted by strife and a shadowy being,
Deceit and Survival on the spaceship Earth Again.
A Stay in Bath takes an unexpected turn in the Austen-inspired Entreaty and Entanglement.
The Screwball 30s Hijinks of Loose Screws.
The Shakespearean comedy of Love's Loyal Laborers.
A love triangle unfolding from the turbulent 60s to the troubled 20-teens.
Behind the music drama in the LA punk scene.
The arrival of a telepathic stranger on a space-bound way station.
Tragic love between a vampire and a mortal.
And an epic multi-generational saga of artificial beings attempting to build a civilization in the tradition of that extinct species, Homo sapiens.
Gorgeously laid out and illustrated by graphic superstar Jen McCleary.
Whoever you want to be, wherever your imagination takes you.
Whether your journey leads to Union Doom or something harder to define.
Page Turners unleashes your story in new and unexpected ways.
The stovepipe hats and the fancy old-timey way of talking, or in this case, the wind in the sails and the creak of the mast tell us we're once more in the History Hut, where beloved patron backer Neon Fox says there's a claim that the SS Waramu straddled the intersection of the equator and the international dateline at midnight on 30th of December 1899, thus being in multiple days, months, seasons, decades, and centuries simultaneously. The efforts to debunk this claim make it a virtual certainty that there was something going on, don't you think? Ken, you're not a debunker, you're not a fun ruiner, but you do care about the facts.
Yes, deeply. And the facts are that the SS Waramu is a real ship. It's 345 feet long, 3,326 gross tons, which is not super big, but was enough for going from Australia to Tasmania, which is why it was originally built. It was built in 1892 in Scotland and sailed to Norway for a shakedown cruise, then down to the Antipodes. It was a passenger liner. It had a capacity of at least 32 passengers, and it also carried refrigerated cargo. And the plan was, as I say, that it was built for the New Zealand and Australian Steamship Company to be a basically a trans-Tasman straight boat, and then maybe a trans-Zealand sea straight boat going like a triangle between those. Eventually, they discovered there was more money going between Vancouver and Australia, so that's what it did. And it started doing that in 1893 and was carrying, you know, Canadians and Australians back and forth, all of them agreeing that the Queen should be on the money. It was no doubt a lovely time. Mark Twain traveled on it from Vancouver to Australia in 1895. So there's the Waramu's brush with greatness. But then it brushed with time itself. In 1899, the story goes that they're heading from Vancouver to Australia, and the first mate goes to the captain and he says, "We are so close to the crossing point of the international dateline and the equator, and it's December 30th, which means we could get there at exactly midnight, and then it would be midnight and 1 second in both years simultaneously, and wouldn't that be cool?" And the captain, having a sense of the potentiality, said, "Let's do it." So they crossed the equator and the international dateline simultaneously at midnight and 1 second, which is to say midnight and 1 second on December 31st. It is then midnight and 1 second simultaneously on January 1st, 1900 at the front of the ship, because the ship has added 24 hours when crossing the 180th meridian, which is, of course, standard maritime procedure. So the four clocks are at January 1st, 1900. The aft clocks are midnight and 1 second, December 31st, 1899. So the back half of the ship is in a different century, decade, and year, and season, as it happens, than the front half of the ship. So that's pretty great. Also, someone points out it's in all four hemispheres simultaneously, because it's in the eastern, western, northern, and southern hemispheres, which is pretty cool. Everyone shakes hands and enjoys themselves, and then they keep going. They've been cheated of a New Year's Eve party, but they've had the best New Year's ever. The ship continues its career. Captain Phillips eventually moves to another ship. In 1914, the Waramo becomes a troop carrier, bringing Anzac troops to Europe. In 1916, it is bought by a Singaporean, a shipping magnate, continues to be a troop carrier. And on the 17th of May, 1918, it is ferrying British troops from Tunisia to Marseille, and it collides with the French destroyer Catapult off the port of Bizerta in Tunisia. The Catapult's depth charges fall overboard and blow up, and both ships sink. The Waramu gets away with the loss of only one life. 58 people on the Catapult die, and that is the sad end of the SS Waramu, and it's sitting at the bottom of the Gulf of Tunis even now, if you want to. So that is the story of the Waramu. And I want to point out that according to a later report in the Ottawa Journal of 1942, Captain John Duthie Sidney Phillips quintuple checked with the first mate the ship's position. So that's pretty good. Now, some people will point out that the Sydney Morning Herald of 1900 only reports that the equator was crossed on December 30th, does not go into the rest of it. But, you know, Captain Phillips is not a braggadocious guy. He's just hanging out, having fun with it. And the story doesn't really blow up until it's reported, as I say, in the Ottawa Journal in 1942, at which point they, you know, get in touch with Captain Phillips and he says, "Oh, I've still got my old logbooks. I just double checked. And sure enough, we did do that," which I think is more than enough evidence that they really did do that. But those jerks and fun ruiners at Snopes, they call the story unproven, Robin. Can you believe it? They don't take the word of an Australian ship captain. They say that it's unproven. And
he has a logbook. How can they doubt his logbook?
I know, right? To make it worse, their illustration on Snopes has the ship going the wrong direction. So what do they know? Nothing. Their source, if I may dignify it as such, is a blog called Spatial Reserves by a no doubt blameless man named Joseph Kursky, who is nonetheless wrong. Kursky complains that the Waramu doesn't have accurate enough instruments to fix its position exactly on the intersection. He says that chronometers, which is what they would have been using for the longitude, have a margin of error of 30 kilometers. And my suspicion is that a professional ship captain and navigator with 50 years of experience between them, including several years on this exact route, are maybe a little better at fixing positions than some guy with a blog who, even by his own admission, has a hard time doing it with GPS. So take that, Joseph Kursky. You come at Captain Phillips.
I like a good cavil, but that's not even a quality cavil because
it's not a good cavil.
It's like he's not saying they didn't do it. It's just saying they might have been in the wrong place. They might have had the instrumentation wrong, which I believe is an entirely separate debunking. That's like a cavil that sort of confirms the original claim.
Yeah, and it's in mean spirit. It's just, well, I can't do it, so I'm sure they couldn't do it. I don't like that attitude. Also, his other cavil is even worse because he points out that the international dateline is not fixed until 1914 Congress and then not accepted by the United States Navy until 1920. But again,
that is like the U.S. to drag its feet on accepting the existence of days.
Yeah, well, you know, we were still trying to make the Philippines keep to American time. So yeah, it was
well, you're
very
busy
confusing.
Belatedly recognizing that sepsis existed, I guess.
Although we did then forcibly move Samoa to American time for about 80 years, which is pretty funny. Anyway, the point is irrelevant because whether a line has been officially signed into existence by a bunch of bureaucrats has no bearing on the fact that ever since Magellan, people have known you have to add a day, and the place to add the day is the 180th meridian, and the actual dateline is where does the meridian move in order to, you know, to not separate island groups, with the exception of Samoa now. And that's what the dateline does. The meridian is still there. The meridian is still the point at which we have been conventionally changing our clocks, or our calendars in this case, for, you know, years and years and years. And certainly a paper on that very topic in the Journal of the British Astronomical Association in 1900 said that adding a day when you cross the 180th meridian going westward has been standard practice in the British Navy for some time. So I think that that puts paid to the petty objections of Joseph Kursky and Snopes. I don't buy it and I don't believe it.
So having established that this is actually real, we have the question, what's really going on? And so I think we need to look at what is a Waramu? What does that name come from? It comes from the Laji-Laji language, one of the many Aboriginal languages of Australia. And according to some definitions, it means eagle. But in other definitions, it means place of the screaming white bird, which I think we know which of those would be involved in a sort of elliptonic story. And what is a ship doing by trying to straddle all of these temporal zones at once? Well, they're trying to, undoubtedly inspired by a chrononaut, that is a recharging station for time machines that have run out of juice. The problem, of course, is that the time machines will all smash into each other if they all appear at the exact same resonant moment and when they're suffering and in need of emergency repairs. And so you have to sort of veil that out a bit by making a doubt appear around the possibility of whether that happened at all in order to, you know, your lesser chrononauts, your recent adoptees of time travel, you want to keep them out of there. Only the time travel agencies, including Time Incorporated in the know, want to maintain space around that, or just maintaining paradox around that is what keeps it charged. And so, Ken, I'm sure on numerous occasions you've had to go and appear for a nanosecond above that moment in order to recharge without crashing into any other time machines, including your own time machine in past and present incarnations of yourself.
I mean, that's the real trouble, is that you are always within a whisker of being on yourself, which is no fun, I can tell you. You know, you think one of me is a party, two of me don't like it. Yeah, the situation is that because you are, as you say, appearing for a fraction of a femtosecond, it's generally easy to do it. But the trouble is the fraction of a femtosecond still has to be on that spot at that point. So the time continuum basically opens up and creates a feedback loop. But the best thing is that it is that rip in the continuum that provides the zero point energy to recharge your time machine. So the time machines right. charge up
like a big white screaming bird.
Right. The big white screaming birds are just from Tsalal, the island sought by Arthur Gordon Pym, and they're all shouting Tekeli Lee, which is not ideal, I grant you, but you know, what could possibly happen in the middle of the Pacific Ocean? I ask you, Robin, nothing.
Right. Well, particularly in the language of the screaming birds is we disbelieve this perfectly credible story, which is very distracting.
Exactly. And it also in Maori means shaking. So the Maori are clearly, they're clued in, and they know that the juddering of all of these time machines, or these few time machines just endlessly repeated, has caused a shaking in the geopositioning of the Waramu, which is what leads to the uncertainty and doubt that allows the Waramu to create the paradox, as you say, necessary for the time machines to have gotten there in the first place. And this is why we don't talk about this stuff, Robin, because the grammar goes to hell.
Right. Well, if we don't talk about it, we better not talk about it. We better listen to a commercial and talk about something else. In the spiral.
Four scenarios embrace the works and deaths of agents between 2016 and 2020, years called the spiral in the Delta Green campaign, God's Teeth.
That span of cruelty and corruption in American government seemed a bitter interregnum.
A momentary eruption of spite.
Now it stands revealed as a preparation for revelations to come.
In God's eye, a baffling disappearance leads the agents to confront the inexorable government panopticon.
They face unnatural revelations unleashed by the death of privacy.
And must survive desperate revenge beneath the sleepless skies.
In God's breath, a Delta Green friendly leaves a frantic voicemail about a Denver prisoner vomiting up an alien worm.
Your agents must identify the unnatural threat.
Trace it to its source.
Burn it out.
Just be careful of the smoke.
In God's law, a shockingly gruesome death leads the agents to a Los Angeles police gang.
It has twisted older, deeper laws towards the tired avarice of corruption.
How far do the agents go to resist the unnatural?
In God's light, the wreckage left by a mass shooter catches Delta Green's attention.
Somehow behind it, a surprising app that reaches strange places on the border between worlds.
The scenarios of God's Hunt are playable with Arc Dream Publishing's Delta Green, the role-playing game.
Play the scenarios on their own, as a cycle, or as a perfect companion to the acclaimed campaign Delta Green, God's Teeth.
Learn more about Delta Green at delta-green.com.
Ensure that this podcast retains its slack by joining such beloved Patreon backers as
Thinking Sideways,
Trung Boy,
John Rogers,
Merrick Shinkariel,
and Jan Zaleski.
The clink of ice, the fizz of the mixer, and the clatter of bottles being moved aside for other different, possibly dustier bottles welcome us into perhaps the best part of the food hut, the liquor cabinet of the food hut, because today we're going to talk about bitters and what are they? Where did they come from? Why are they so bitter? All of these questions will be answered mostly by Robin, who I think it's fair to say of the two of us is the bigger bitter. I should have a B thing.
I'm not embittered, but I own many bottles of bitters.
But you do own many bitters.
I'm a bitters enthusiast, right. Particularly since today's bitters are not bitter.
A bitters boffin. That was what I should have said.
There we go. So Bitters are just simply a liquid concoction consisting of alcohol and water and super concentrated flavoring. And you can use them to add, in the classic version, flavor to cocktails, but we'll get into other things that you might want to flavor as well. The idea of doing this, of adding particularly herbs to create a concentrate, starts with the ancient Egyptians. They used wine, so you can quibble as to whether they were fully bitters or not. When distillation becomes a thing in the late Middle Ages, that is when bitters, as we would recognize them, come into play. And they're considered perhaps even more a digestive than a flavoring agent, because they were originally made with bitter herbs and other plants. And that's where the name comes from. Many of us dislike the bitter taste. So even the name today makes it sound somewhat unattractive, shall we say. Mm-hmm. But at any rate, the original ingredients often included like orange peel, Chinese cinnamon, gentian, which is a trumpet-like flower that is used to flavor various things, roots, and various barks, such as the cinchona bark. And this is where we get to another use of bitters, in that the real source of bitter flavor, because it has quinine in it, it's more colorfully known as Jesuit's bark, because in the Age of Exploration, the dumb Jesuits were trying to get people not to get malaria and made them try and get quinine in them by consuming various drafts of cinchona bark. I don't know if they were making bitters to get them to do that, but anyway. So this flavoring agent for alcohol, we think if you go now into a cocktail emporium, you'll find shelf after shelf of these things. But for the longest time, there were really only two or two and a half widely used bitters concoctions to flavor cocktails. The first one is the Angostura bitters, our list of things that still exists. And it is heavy on the gentian, and it was goes all the way back to 1824. It was manufactured in 1824 and developed slightly earlier than that by its creator, a German doctor, Johann Gottlieb Benjamin Siegert. He invented it in Venezuela while he was Surgeon General to Simon Bolivar. I don't know if that was an anti-malarial effort that turned into
It was invented as a febrifuge by Dr. Siegert. And to clear something up, Angostura bitters do not have Angostura bark in them. They were made on the Angostura River when Siegert first made them, which is why they're Angostura bitters, not, you know, Orinoco bitters or some other kind of bitters.
Right.
But yeah, it began as a febrifuge, and only very lately, not very lately, but only, you know, a generation or two after, did it start becoming a thing you added to cocktails. When you read about bitters in the first ever description of the cocktail, which is in 1806 in an American newspaper, it includes the word bitters, which probably at that time meant canary wine, which would have been a kind of Madeira or similar sweetened wine that had gentian and other bitter stuff in it to change the taste and make it more medicinal. And then mixing that with alcohol was how you took your medicine. And also they had it around and they said, oh, let's just turn that into the thing we're going to put in this rum punch or this mint julep or this stone fence. And suddenly we have, you know, a lovely whiskey cocktail.
Yes, because also alcohol was a thing you had alcohol with.
Right, yeah, that always helps.
Yeah. And so the other bitters that you can still go and buy today, that was one of the two kings of bitters, is Peychaud's bitters. It was formulated somewhere between 1849 and 1857 by Antoine Amédée Peychaud. By that time, he was living in New Orleans, where he lived most of his life. He was originally from Haiti. And it adds a bit of anise, a little sort of licorice flavor to the gentian of Angostura. And also has a fun red color. So it's an exciting little visual twist that you add to a drink as well. Bitters almost died off completely during the Prohibition, because you can't really sell bar accessories, including bar ingredients, if people aren't overtly drinking. When they are drinking, they're not worried so much about getting Angostura bitters. They're just trying to get something they can drink.
Although you'll be delighted to know, Robin, that the oldest bar in Door County changed itself from a bar to a pharmacy during Prohibition and sold just bitters for the length of Prohibition, saying, this is a medicine. I don't know what you're talking about. Medicines can contain alcohol. It says so in the law.
That may have been the heroic pharmacy that kept bitters alive.
Right.
And at different times in different jurisdictions, there have been things sold as bitters because you don't need a liquor license to sell them, that have kind of rather a high alcohol content and are no longer a flavoring agent, but in fact are sold to people who are usually desperate alcoholics who need to be able to grab something at a convenience store.
Well, I said Door County, Wisconsin. So yes, desperate right. alcoholics is implied.
Right. So the vast panoply of exciting different flavors of bitters that you see today in a cocktail emporium, that's extremely new. That's like with the advent of the craft cocktail movement, and there's more companies coming online and thinking of more new, exciting, fun, non-bitter flavors all the time. So the question is, other than following the recipes of cocktail cookbooks or recipe books, what do you do with bitters? Because you can do a bunch of other things with them. One thing that I will do is sort of make a mocktail when I want to have something that has a complex flavor, but I'm not looking to be made somewhat sleepy by having a shot of alcohol. I will often add a bitter to, for example, a Diet Cola. And what those will do is it will take the worst, crummiest variety of Diet Cola and make them quite good and interesting. And so I will often put 5 or 6 dashes of an interesting bitter into that, and it will be quite fun. Now, I'm not sure how many other things I would do that with. I'm not a Sprite person. So right. You will have to, listeners, do your own Peychaud Sprite experiments. I certainly wouldn't put it in root beer, which has got enough going on as it is.
You'd probably do it in ginger ale. I'll bet that'd be fun.
I bet that would be good in ginger ale. Another, I think, underutilized place to put bitters is beer. Often, I like to have a number of different flavors going on in something. And if I have a good but somewhat unexciting lager or pilsner on hand, I will jazz it up with a bit of bitters. And that's a way, for me anyway, of getting a fruit-flavored beer that isn't a sour, because I don't care for sours, but I don't mind a little bit of fruit flavoring in a beer. My ultimate triumph, however, bitters-wise and beer-wise, is a local brewery, or local insofar as I'm within shipping range of them, has a beer that they periodically release. And to signal that I would really like it, they call it Blood of Cthulhu. And that is their standard imperial stout with some cranberry flavoring added. Now, it transpires that they only have Blood of Cthulhu every so often. Like the last time they made it was like they went for 2 years without making it. They usually have some other flavored imperial stout, and their regular imperial stout they always have. I don't even want to name their imperial stout because it's a stupid juvenile name. But if you order stupid juvenile imperial stout from Sawdust City and you have cranberry bitters, you can create Blood of Cthulhu whenever you darn want to, Ken.
And all so day long.
I can trick the universe into giving me one of my favorite beers. You can also put bitters in coffee and have a little bit of a flavor of something going on. There are many sort of nut-flavored bitters. And so if you're a person who doesn't want anything sweet in your coffee, but you still want it to have an interesting flavor going on, you can use bitters for that and get a more sophisticated result. We are a coffee syrup household sometimes, and one of our favorite coffee syrups is hard to find. So we make it by taking a vanilla syrup and adding cinnamon bitters to it. And that works quite well. Bitters in hot chocolate is also fun and exciting. I think with those ones, you want to stick with the kind of more obvious flavors, your cherry or maybe your orange, rather than, you know, one of the stranger combinations, but that's quite lovely.
And orange bitters do go back to a good long time. You have an orange bitters recipe, for example, in a cookbook from 1864, but the orange bitters that you get now were formulated in the 1990s by a guy named Mark Regan, and which is why you usually see them as Regan's orange bitters, and they are delicious. And quite frankly, they, I think, do a lot for a lot of different cocktails. And even if you're not supposed to be putting bitters in, you know, your specific thing, or you're supposed to be putting a different bitters in, try it with Regan's orange and see what that does.
Yeah. And cocktail-wise, you want to be putting bitters in something that is already kind of on the simpler range of things. So there's no, if you're putting something that has one of the ingredients is liqueur 43 or curacao or something, or Lillet, that's already complicated enough. You don't need to put bitters in that.
Yeah, that's basically filling that slot.
Right. But if you're just dealing with something that's a rum or a whiskey or something relatively straightforward, when you're making a cocktail, that's when you want to grab the bitters. Bitters might make herbal tea drinkable. I don't know. You tell me.
Yeah.
And also for flavoring cakes, it turns out that they work quite well. And I would argue better than like the orange extract or whatever that you would buy in the cake decorating section. if you want to recreate a cake flavor that you liked when you were a kid and they don't make that cake flavor anymore, for example, orange flavored cake, that's one of my favorites. And when Valerie makes me a birthday cake, we'll sometimes do that. And now she does that with orange bitters.
And I think that I've had a custard pie that was bitters adjacent, that someone put bitters in to sort of cut through the overwhelming sweetness and stickiness of the custard, which again, I like the overwhelming sweetness and stickiness of a good custard, but one with a interesting bitters flavor is going to be interesting and sweet. And that is, I think, a little bit better. So think about custard pies.
Yeah, I haven't experimented with anything like a creme brulee or like a whipped cream, but I bet since you're putting in tiny little droplets, I don't think that would mess with the cooking chemistry that much.
And talking about elevating things that are garbage, it suddenly occurs to me, and I have not tested this, but maybe people want to, you know, that horrible instant pudding that you get, I'll bet you could put a couple of shots of a tasty bitters into like a vanilla instant pudding, and suddenly you'd have something kind of fun and interesting to eat.
That is an interesting experiment if you're trapped on a desert island with only...
with instant pudding and bitters.
Yeah.
It's a weird desert island.
Yeah.
It's a food desert island.
Right. So if you're getting into the world of bitters, you got to start with Angostura and or Peychaud's as your starting version. The obvious starting points are orange, as we've already mentioned. That's the first bitters had orange peels in them, and that has a long pedigree, and that's because it works. It's good. Cherry, I think, is also one of the fruit-flavored bitters that you're going to reach for first. But as we've suggested, I have a lot of bitters now. I love to get them. Valerie will get one for me for a birthday or Christmas present. That's always a fun thing to open. As previously mentioned, cranberry is essential for making your own Blood of Cthulhu. Coffee pecan is one of my favorites. I will also speak up for the rhubarb bitters. And other ones that I've quite enjoyed in different combinations are cardamom. Vanilla and fig is really good. There's a mole one made by a local bitters company. A very Canadian one is spiced maple. That's quite tasty. And also toasted almond is one that I think is I'd almost nominate into the inner circle of obvious starting points.
Well, I'm not going to go bitters by bitters against your panoply, Robin. I find that I can do most things that I want with the basic basics, your Peychaud's, Angostura, cherry orange. I think I used to have a coffee bitters that I probably used up, so maybe I need to get that again. And I might mention that there are things that are basically bitters that are, in fact, what we might also think of as a concentrated absinthe. So the Fee brothers, or Fay brothers, however they pronounce it, have an herb saint that is basically a concentrated version of phony absinthe, and it's got the wormwood and whatnot. So that's another branch of bitters, and you should usually have that around if you're don't want to keep absinthe on hand, because you don't want to shoot Paul Verlaine, God forbid.
Yes, you don't want a bunch of Belle Epoque ghosts hanging around. That's a problem that attracts the Yellow King. Well, having, I think, covered the highly concentrated world of bitters in a highly concentrated segment, it's time for us to see what lurks at the end of this here podcast. The British are coming!
To the American South and the lands over the mountains in Flagbearer Games' exciting Revolutionary War role-playing game, Nations and Cannons.
Thoroughly researched and beautifully illustrated, in Nations and Cannons you play as spies, skirmishers, and saboteurs in the battle for the future of the 13 colonies.
Ken and Robin listeners can download a free PDF copy of the core rules from nationsandcannons.com using code KenRobin.
And educators can get a physical copy for use in the classroom absolutely free.
The next book, The American Crisis, Dark and Bloody Ground, follows the actions of the war in the South and the West, with historical adventures, setting information, perfidious new enemies, and a sprawling campaign.
Salvage the rebels' foreign alliances in Haiti and Spanish New Orleans.
Recover a mysterious map from Daniel Boone.
Sail into the heart of darkness, investigating George Rogers Clark's strange conquest of Vincennes.
Escape when all seems lost at Savannah and Charleston.
Fight the guerrilla war alongside the Swamp Fox in a fast-moving hex crawl.
And save the revolution at the climax at York. Town.
Sign up to be notified of the Kickstarter campaign at yourdadwilllovethis.com. the furtive looks, the paranoid scrawls, the shifty looking guy stapling handmade handbills onto the side of a fence tell us that we're once more in that most questionable of corners, the conspiracy corner. But this time around, I've managed to stumble across a conspiracy theory that is both recent and still kind of fun, because Ken, tell us about the theory that the CIA assassinated an island.
Yes. Well, since the island isn't there, it must not have been the CIA that did it. It must have been someone good at assassinating people. But
people in other countries think the CIA can do stuff, Ken.
Right. That's the conspiracy theory, is that the CIA is good at its job. The island of Bermeja is first mapped in 1535 by a Portuguese navigator named Gaspar Viejas, and it appears on a map, a very famous atlas by Alonso de Santa Cruz in 1539, which is called A Description of All the Islands of the World, which is a great motto for an atlas. And it appears Bermejo, according to Santa Cruz's footnote, which means blondish red or reddish blonde in Spanish. And so it is Isla Bermeja, the blonde or reddish blonde island. They mapped it to about 230 miles north-northwest of Campeche in Yucatan. It's about 30 square miles. Ortelius puts it on his map, his very, very influential and famous world map, as Vermeja, and that's in 1564. And with Ortelius behind it, it's staying on maps as late as 1846, when Henry S. Tanner draws a map of Mexico for the American government, because we're going to war with it, and it would be nice to know what's down there. And it's as late as 1921, it appears on the Atlas of the Mexican Republic. There is an American atlas in 1914 that depicts it as an American possession, but I could not find the name of that atlas. I just saw that map everywhere. And it's still a pin on Google Maps today, but even Google Maps does not have an island there.
Right. And it's quite common for misapprehended islands to, first of all, be misapprehended, that it's easy enough to mistake, for example, clouds near the horizon for an island, or there's a whole history of claiming the existence of islands that don't exist. Sometimes it's a genuine mistake by ship's navigators. Sometimes it's an active hoax. And this one, for all we know, for those of us who believe the island never existed, was just a misapprehension.
Was just a phantom island, as they call them. And indeed, the Spanish naval cartographer Chiraco Ceballos does an 1803 to 1808 exploration of the Gulf of Mexico and the Yucatan. He can't find the island of Bermeja, which is possibly why he was sent into exile in New Orleans in 1809. Don't believe the hype that it was done for political reasons. He may have been trying to bust open the secret island cabal. The British naval chart from 1844 allegedly shows it as a submerged reef, 60 fathoms down. I have not seen this chart. I have only seen descriptions of it. And allegedly in 1902, a French naval vessel couldn't find Bermeja and theoretically caused a wave of press in the sort of Vernian mode of island disappears, which is great fun. And people right. who believe that there used to be Bermeja, but there isn't Bermeja now, say, well, it was obviously climate change that drowned it, or maybe an earthquake or a volcano took it out, which founders a bit on the rocks of the Mexican government very seriously trying to find Bermeja, because if it existed, it would extend their border in the Gulf of Mexico up north by 55 miles, and therefore entitled them to 22.5 million barrels of oil reserves that are currently American territory. And so they had every incentive to find Bermeja, but they tried to find it in 1997, and they failed. And then in 2009, the National University of Mexico sent three expeditions with the best equipment in the world to, you know, sound the bottom. And they came back and they said there was never an island there. The site of Bermeja is undisturbed ocean floor sediments. There's no sign of a volcano. There's no sign of an upthrust. There's certainly no sign of a British rock. It just isn't there. And wonderfully, the cartographer on the committee said, well, it's on a bunch of maps. I think it's there. So I just love that they've still got people holding out and saying it wouldn't be on a map if it wasn't real.
Don't trust your stupid eyes. It's on right. a map. Ortelius said it was on a map.
Yeah. Are you calling Ortelius a liar? You monster.
Right. Well, so the 22.5 billion barrels of oil is a strong motivation not only to find an island, but to murder an island, to have it assassinated. So this is where we get the theory that the CIA had it whacked.
Yeah. After the Mexican government came back and said, couldn't find the island, a senator named Jose Concello said, well, you guys are obviously in the bag for El Norte and you're covering up the island, or conversely, the CIA destroyed the island, that they made it vanish. And he was a big proponent of that. He kept, you know, proposing senatorial inquiries. And then he died in an entirely coincidental car crash in 1998.
There is no coincidence in Conspiracy Corner. It's obviously a cover-up.
Right. And so after the 2009 university search also found nothing, a deputy, which is what they call representatives in Mexico, named Elias Cardenas, also reiterated in 2010 that the CIA destroyed it, saying, such a force of nature does not take place without anyone noticing, and much less so when it is sitting in an area with more than 22 billion barrels of oil reserves. So the CIA, possibly in cahoots with David Copperfield, went out and vanished the island because Obviously if you destroyed it with physical force, there'd be rubble there. And also someone would have noticed the H-bombs going off because you can't destroy an island a little smaller than Manhattan with any sort of conventional explosive. So
Saul Milan of the National Polytechnic Institute made exactly that point. He said that a hydrogen bomb would be required to destroy an island of this size. And since the CIA obviously killed this island, what the Americans did was they shaved the top off it, which I think is strong reasoning for Conspiracy Corner.
Right.
A geographer at UNAM, just Mexican Science Incorporated, also says that the island exists for sure. Absolutely. It's just not at its purported location. It's somewhere else.
Yeah. And that's the cartographer who says it's been on maps. Therefore, it must be real. That's that same person. And right. So the notion that the CIA, I don't know which I like better, frankly, that the CIA went back and forged all the old maps to move the island. Went very wag the dog, very cool. I love the idea that the American, you know, Department of the Archives or somebody is out there making fake maps to slowly move American boundaries outward so that nobody notices. And the 1914 Atlas that I can't find any record of is a bit of a modified limited hangout for this plan. Or that our team of submarine bulldozers came out and shaved the island, probably, you know, in our spare time from digging our UFO bases underneath the Continental Trench, where all of our secret submarine bases are. I guess once you've dug two or three tunnels for our Mars crossing super vessels to erupt from, you know, you can use that same equipment to sort of just, you know, give an island a back and sides, right?
Right. And I'm sure our listeners, as soon as they're starting to hear about islands that are there sometimes and not other times, are starting, of course, to think about Deep Ones and Cthulhu. I think Deep Ones, I assume there are some Deep Ones after 1925 who switched sides and now work for the CIA. They're probably experts in making islands rise and fall. And that involves a simple ritual. There's no detectable science involved with that. So you can have that. Or perhaps it is their attempt to forestall a premature rising of Rilia. It's on the other side of the world, but they may be sort of trying to keep things in balance. And, you know, they want to make sure that when the big guy shows up, that they've got all the groundwork laid. And so since they lost Innsmouth, maybe they're just trying to delay that a little bit.
Or maybe the island exists in a dimensional rift. And sometimes it's there and sometimes it's not. And we're using Philadelphia experiment technology to sail to and from Bermeja and tune the rift so that the Mexicans can't find it.
It could also simply be the case that Deep Ones don't want you mining all of that undersea oil. That wrecks their habitat. So they may be...
Well, they don't want the Mexicans to mine it. That's the rotten thing about Deep Ones. I guess once you're a New Englander, you're always a New Englander, right?
Yeah, I guess that's it.
Yep. So now that once more we've blamed the CIA and New England for everything wrong in America and Mexico, clearly the job of the Conspiracy Corner is done, and indeed, perhaps the job of this whole episode. But don't worry, next week we'll be back with more blame to go around and more nonsense to be blamed upon.
Stuff having once again been talked about, it's time to thank our sponsors.
Atlas Games.
Pelgrane Press.
Arc Dream.
Flagbearer Games.
Dork Tower.
And Pro Fantasy Software.
Music, as always, is by James Semple.
Audio editing by Rob Borges.
Support our Patreon at patreon.com/KenAndRobin.
Keep this podcast tasting like wild Canadian plum by joining such backers as
Andrew Cowie,
Andrew Dacey,
Bart Molio,
Josh King,
and Keelan O'Hay.
Wear this show or drink it from a mug with Ken and Robin merch at kenrobin.dashery.com.
Celebrate your joy of missing out with our latest design, Jomo.
On X, he's at Kenneth Height.
And on Blue Sky, he's robindlaws.bisky.social.
See you next time when, once again, we will talk about stuff.